Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue along with Ray Graff. Good morning, Raymond.
Hi.
How are you?
I am well.
University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter. Ray, the person who got here on time.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin did too, but anyone who had to use the Northway was in
the big
incredible.
Stars take their time.
University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo.
I'd like to think of it as a grand entrance, not being late.
That was nice.
Yes.
It was Bob a good entrance. Hope-esque there.
Very much. Hey, you know, I was thinking about that yesterday. You know, Bob Hope used to, Kevin Moran is here as well, by the way.
Yeah.
Kevin
hey.
Moran.
Oh, hi. Oh, and him too.
Regional Vice President of News for New England Newspapers, and it's a pleasure to have him with us. He is was in the Media Project this week and is sitting in with us this morning, and we're thrilled to have him. Is this the first time you have ever been with us on the roundtable in our studio?
In studio. I've done so many remotes.
Yeah.
That I feel like you guys broadcast like, perpetually from Tanglewood.
Kevin's our roadie.
And,
yeah.
So it's great to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here in person.
Yeah, that's really
seeing how it's done.
That's really nice. Well, speaking of the Berkshires and speaking of Bob Hope, you know, Bob Hope used to have those great walk-ons.
Yeah, on
the Tonight Show, and all of a sudden Bob Hope would just walk out. You know, oh, I'm just walking down the aisle. I'm just walking down the hall, Johnny. I've got this special coming up on Friday night.
Yeah,
and those were legendary. Yesterday on the roundtable, we're doing our show.
And Bob Hope showed up?
Yes, he did. It was really something.
James Taylor showed up.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
It was
cool.
Like we're just talking on the phone. All of a sudden, boom, James Taylor.
Amazing.
It was great. It was really fun.
I heard rumors of that.
Wow.
I must say I was not actually listening.
Did he sing?
No. Although what would have been great, of course, is if he just, you know, did Thanks for the Memories.
That would have been really odd.
Yeah, it would have been a little odd, but it would have been fun. Welcome all. We have a great panel and a lot of good topics to talk about. Let's talk about the shutdown, because I think that's all you're allowed to talk to.
Yeah.
Talk about. That's what we have to talk about.
What happened to Syria? Remember that?
Yeah. What happened about that?
I think we said that yesterday. It's like
what happened to Syria?
Yeah.
Hearing a little more about Egypt now, which is interesting.
Yes.
We'll talk about that in a moment. But let us talk about what is happening. And we have been kind of murmuring about this all week, about the fact that the GOP was giving up on Obamacare. And so now business groups are starting to get a little involved. And there's an interesting article in the New York Times today that says that the government shutdown grinds toward a potential debt default. Some of the country's most influential business executives have come to a conclusion all but unthinkable a few years ago, that their voices are carrying little weight with the House majority, and their millions of dollars in campaign contributions help build and sustain. Their frustration has grown so intense in recent days that several trade association officials warned in interviews on Wednesday that they were considering helping wage primary campaigns against Republican lawmakers who had worked to engineer the political standoff in Washington. Was this something you think that the Republicans saw coming?
We saw it coming. How could they have missed it? We talked about this for several days ago, that the Republicans seem to be missing the interests of their main constituents. Is that not true?
Yes, we did. But I mean, like, how does that not come up on the radar? So then you would take from that they don't care.
They don't care.
Right.
Yeah.
I would agree. I mean, what are they? What is the goal? What is their goal right now? You have to you have to sit back and understand that, you know, there's so much a lack of direction, even with the party. And you're looking at the party and it's fractured and you're wondering who's leading who. It's kind of a scary time. I'm actually, you know, feeling unnerved by all of this lately. And we've been through these things before, but why is this different this time?
Have you seen the AP study, the poll? It's the lowest rating I've ever heard of. 5% approval of Congress. So we're not the only ones sitting back appalled and wondering what in the heck is going on.
I mean, how could, you know, this sounds awful, but, you know, should they deserve any more than that? I mean, almost I find that somewhat reassuring,
right,
that it's getting through, that there is an issue and that there's a problem.
I'd love to see the actual question and the breakdown of the parties in that 5%. In other words, how do they What did they ask to get to that?
They only asked Democrats. And
No. But I mean, what was the actual question?
Yeah, that's good. I don't know that.
Okay.
Yeah. I can actually. What
is the 5% thinking they actually like these guys?
They're doing a great job.
Well, those 5% are, that's the actual Congress. Those are actually congressional representatives.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're good with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're good.
Yeah. It seems to be coming clearer that it's the shutdown that they wanted, that is the effect they want. And there's no logic to that. There's just no reason that I've been looking for other explanations of this, and I don't find anyone who explains it to me.
We mentioned, we've been talking about polls. A lot of polls are out. Let's just do a quick rundown here. A number of new polls have found rising exasperation with a dysfunctional government and economic concern. A Gallup poll released yesterday found that Americans are now more likely to cite their own government as the biggest problem facing the country. Responding to an open-ended question, 33% of Americans said the nation's most important problem was the government, politicians, or Congress, up from 16% who said so last month, and the highest since Gallup began asking the question in 1939. I love that in 1939 they were still asking this question of, yeah, do you feel the government is against you? Americans' naming of the economy or jobs as the nation's number one issue has been on the decline this year. About one in five specified the economy, while about one in 10 said unemployment. The Republican Party netted the worst ratings during the first week of the shutdown. Just 28% of Americans now find it favorable, down 10 points from September, and the lowest rating for either party since Gallup started measuring party favorability in 1992. And while the economy may not be seen as the nation's biggest issue, Gallup also found that Americans' confidence in the economy declined as the government shutdown took hold. Meanwhile, United Technologies National Journal Congressional Connection poll released this week found that the country is somewhat divided about what will happen if the nation misses the deadline to increase its statutory borrowing limit, with nearly half of Americans saying it is essential to raise the limit in order to avoid an economic crisis, about 4 in 10 saying that no major economic problems will occur if the deadline passes, 1 in 7 saying they don't know. So basically,
it is a dumb poll. Asking everyone here what's going to happen if such and such happens. That's, you know, why don't we poll Nostradamus too? And then he can tell us. That's ridiculous.
Might be a little bit more accurate.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Well, the news this morning, though, is that there is a movement afoot to perhaps get a temporary debt limit increase, so that we can then fight more and with more greater effect on all the other issues.
And
of
how
debt.
Long that was?
It buys you time.
It buys you time.
Yes.
Right?
Thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That seems to be gaining strength, as I understand it.
The plan would temporarily raise the debt limit, but keep the partial government shutdown in place. I believe the headline at CNN was progress, question mark. not a total solution and still plenty of work to be done. But House Republican leaders are considering a plan to temporarily raise the nation's borrowing limit while keeping the partial government shutdown in place. The proposal would include demands for negotiations on issues related to the national debt, although it's unclear precisely what form those talks would take. And, of course, this is what the Republicans have wanted all along, to quote-unquote negotiate with the president. House Republicans are scheduled to meet this morning to discuss the idea, while GOP leaders will travel to the White House in the afternoon to meet with the president. Some of Democrats have a separate meeting scheduled with the president of the United States as well. At a private White House meeting with House Democrats on Wednesday, President Obama said he would consider a short-term deal to raise the federal borrowing limit. If that's what the House Speaker needs to climb out of the tree that he's stuck in, then that's something we should look at.
How magnanimous.
According to a lawmaker who attended the meeting and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Although
that quote certainly needed to be anonymous.
Yeah. Sure.
Although I kind of want to know who said it, because it's a great quote.
So my big question
is,
what do I do what do I do with stocks in the stock market? Do I invest more? Because what's going to be the effect of this? So I know this is sort of like polling people equally
exactly.
about what to do. But
it's
maybe we should bring
again.
Yeah, maybe we should bring in a stock analyst here to say, is it time to buy now? Because everything could be crashing down.
And
it might come back in the future. I don't know.
And what do you think? What do you think the average American is feeling? Because I mean, we're as Kevin mentioned, we're used to turbulence, and even in that poll,
kind of like it,
and even
I get
as
used to it, and that's
makes
scary.
Good TV.
That it is scary, yeah. And even as of the poll that we just talked about, which I believe the direct quote was. That's a stupid poll, according to
dumb.
That's a dumb poll, according to Ray. But still, half the people are saying, all right.
Well, clearly, I mean, we have just been coming out of many years of really hard times for the United States, and by all indicators, a lot of the lines are going up. There are fewer unemployed. Certain parts of the aspects of the economy are doing better, and all of a sudden, here we land in this mess. That seems just that is, I feel like it's going to sink us, and I hate feeling that way.
Yeah.
And here is a time when we need, our leadership, and I mean that in a bipartisan way, to be inspirational, not destructive. I mean, this is not the right time. And I'm talking not only for the economy of the United States, but just for our own psyche. We've been on the grind with this economic stuff. And here we are now with, apparently a government that just, can't work.
It's true.
The Prime Minister of China had a meeting with John Kerry yesterday. The meeting was on other issues, however, in what is called a sideline meeting.
Sort of came up, huh?
They had a 75-minute conversation in which the Prime Minister said, we're highly concerned about this, and please give us a reason why we shouldn't be highly concerned about this. And it is so that obviously is playing into this as well. We talked about this earlier in the week of what impact this is going to have on the
world economy. We saw the president not showing up at two Asian conferences. That the president of the United States should have been there. It's what Kevin said.
We owe them so much money. No wonder they're pulling aside for a brief 75-minute conversation.
Yeah. The landlord wants to speak to you.
Right.
$1.2 trillion.
That's it?
Wow. And we owe Japan $1.1
trillion. Oh, good.
Oh, trillion. Boy.
So we will continue our conversation. We're going to take a break for the news, and when we come back, we'll talk about other issues as well. We welcome your comments, as always, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to the program. WAMC's Ray Graff is here, University of Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo. We lost Kevin Moran on the break.
Yeah. Oh, look at the time. Oh, geez, I've had fun. Gone. He's already like on I-90 by now.
Which we knew. We knew.
Oh,
it
we knew
advance.
That. Oh, yes, oh, we knew okay. it in advance. Oh, I Kevin thought he had just had enough.
No, Kevin has a meeting over in Vermont and has to get to, which we knew because
maybe
of the,
somebody else will just drop by. Just
yeah,
come on
that's
in
right. And, our walk
Bob Hope.
Yeah,
right.
Bob Hope.
Right. Yeah, just walking down the hall. I'm doing a special, Johnny.
The Obama administration on Wednesday announced a, quote, modest and temporary freeze on military assistance to Egypt, even as American officials emphasized their desire to avoid rupturing a security relationship that stretches back more than three decades. To signal its displeasure at the Egyptian military's bloody crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood, officials said the United States would withhold the delivery of several big-ticket items, including Apache attack helicopters, harpoon missiles, M1, A1 tank parts, and F-16 warplanes, as well as $260 million for the general Egyptian budget. This is something that was discussed weeks ago during the initial crackdown and something that seems to just be coming to fruition.
Well, after what was a coup despite the Obama administration not using that word. The government was thrown out. That shows you don't have a democratic process going on. The government is supposed to take back all aid. That should have been done, and it was not.
For 6 months.
For 6 months. And yeah. Now we're revisiting it. Still aren't taking, they are not taking all of the aid back. They've just adjusted it.
Right. So, and the... in a sign of this balance of how the administration is balancing its interests, senior officials said the United States would continue aid for counterterrorism programs as well as for Egypt's efforts to protect its borders and secure Sinai, which has become a haven for extremists.
Do we know how much that is in comparison to what they're holding back? In other words, if it's a lot, then they just reapportion what they consider to be anti-terrorism efforts.
The total of what they're withdrawing is minuscule compared to what they're still giving.
Okay.
And it's important.
It's lip service.
Yeah. Well, it's I don't know, lip service, although it's hard to think of any good reason we should be sending Apache helicopters to Egypt. What good does that do us or the region?
Well, we've been military. I mean, there has been relative, in that particular spot,
yes,
relative geopolitical stability.
Sure.
And part of it is because we've been allies with them.
But the government that supplied that stability is long gone. That was Mubarak. We give more aid to Egypt than to any other country except for Israel, also in the region. And we propped up what the people there thought was a bad administration. There is not a replacement. There's military rule now. So we are giving military coup, people who threw out the democratically elected government, despite what we think of them. They were fairly put there. And we are giving them aid and assistance. It doesn't – I don't see how that helps the United States. Of course, I don't
think
our whole aid program –
So you would advocate pulling all money, all aid to Egypt?
Yeah, for a while I would. I really think that this country could do with a good discussion. I mean, hell, we don't even discuss our budget logically, much less the budget of other countries. But our aid program is a mess.
Well, we could certainly use the extra money. I'll tell you that.
That's a sidelight I didn't even think of.
Debt ceiling shmeling. Yeah. We can take it from here.
Give him a couple
take it
of
out
million.
Of Egypt's money. Yeah.
Take it from Egypt.
But what do we hope to accomplish with aid? And are we giving it to the right places? We don't have these discussions. It's all, like everything else, based on what we did in the past and who's in favor and lobbying.
But I mean, it's certainly a relic of Cold War maneuvering, and it has its place, right? I mean, giving money to countries that you are allied with,
and we seem to
has its place.
Don't get me wrong, absolutely, but Egypt clearly is not allied with us anymore. Yet we're still giving them an outsized piece of our total foreign aid pot.
The administration, this from the article, just to reiterate Rosemary's point from a moment ago, and that is the administration continued to take the position that it was not obligated to classify Mr. Morsi's ouster as a coup, a judgment that could have required a wholesale suspension in aid. The aid that the administration is holding back, officials say, could be restored if Egypt's interim leaders take steps towards restoring democracy. The announcement laid bare the underlying calculations that have shaped the United States' effort to respond to the upheaval in Egypt ever since the crackdown began in July, leaving more than 1,000 people dead. American officials have long doubted that cutting back military aid would have any effect on the behavior of Egypt's military-backed government.
No, then it's money down a hole.
Right. Then why? Back to the original point of then why bother?
Well, you know, our military, I mean, maybe there's some personal dynamics in play here. Right. Our military is tight and has been for so long with the Egyptian military. They train here. We work together. So there may be some personal relationships at play involved in this. And also, I don't know if I say it's fully throwing money away. I mean, if there's stability, if a major military power has not attacked Israel since 1973. That's some stability.
The word that I like, maybe instead of throwing it away, is muddled. That was the word that Patrick Leahy used, saying the administration is trying to have it both ways by suspending some aid but continuing other aid. Senator Leahy is chairman of the subcommittee that appropriates aid to Egypt. He said by doing that, the message is extremely muddled.
Yeah, we don't. Well,
we get that a lot in Washington.
Yeah, it's exactly right. What is our policy? What should be our policy towards Egypt? We haven't figured that out.
So you're left with something, and Ray mentioned this, more symbolic than actually substantive.
Yeah, based on what we've done in the past, personal connections, absolutely. Not good policy.
We're going to take a break. When we continue, we will talk about Syria and other issues. We're going to try to find some things that some issues that make Ray happy.
Well, okay.
What?
No, nothing. I mean, I'm happy, right?
No, I know
I'm
you
always
are happy.
A team
you are
player
happy. And... You were saying, can we
just do the break?
All right. You're listening to the Roundtable. Ray was making requests earlier.
Yeah.
On stories.
Can you play Far, Far Away?
We want to make sure we honor those requests. We'll be back right after the short break.
Support comes from Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock, New York, a specialty health food store with organic produce, including fall pears, eggplant, apples, squash, and garlic. Sunflowernatural.com for new mobile app with hours, event information, and more. Bridgeside Grill, Sunderland Center, Massachusetts, offering lunch and dinner daily and brunch on weekends, featuring seasonal outdoor dining, member of CISA since 2007. Bridgesidegrill.com for menu. And Haldora, Rhinebeck, women's clothing designed by Haldora for upstate lifestyles, special occasions, or travel. Also featuring cashmere sweaters, jeans, jewelry, and undergarments. 845-876-6250.
The Obama administration on Wednesday announced, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong story. Good morning and welcome back to the roundtable. Yeah, thank you very much, Ray. Take two. We are, you know what happened?
Something happened with your iPad, yes?
Yes.
Oh, God. We hear that so much, don't we?
Do you see what I have? I have
paper.
A piece of paper.
And a pencil.
Old
it works.
School.
Right.
You're talking to a microphone. You don't need these iPads. You get some wire. You get the teleprinter out there. No, I have to have an iPad. I'm Joe Donahue, the star of the show. Go ahead. Use your iPad.
We talked yesterday. It's a laptop, by the way.
Whatever.
It's what we call a computer. Okay.
Just filling for time while you find the page, man.
Thank you very much. It was a brilliant dialogue. So the head of the international watchdog.
It's so fun to watch professionals at work, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, I know it is, isn't it? Well, when you find them, let us know.
Yeah.
The watchdog overseeing the destruction of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal said yesterday, late last night, that a team of 15 inspectors had begun to visit sites that the Syrian authorities had been quite constructive and cooperative. The official director general of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons said completing the work within the extremely tight deadline of mid-2014 agreed on by the United States and Russia would depend on whether temporary ceasefires could be arranged between government and opposition forces. Inspectors supported by the United Nations have already visited one site and were set to visit another today. So
yeah.
those searches those inspections go on, and from the initial word are
succeeding,
are yeah. constructive. So
I would like to see this as a very good and big story, that two superpowers who were at odds came together in a really short period of time, said let's fix this. We did not get involved in Syria because as a result, and now it's actually proceeding. It may actually work.
You won't know if it succeeds until we know whether all of the chemical weapons have been accounted for.
That is true. There's all kinds of problems with this, but it's still a hell of a lot better than sending missiles and or soldiers over there.
I mean, we were moments away there, it seemed,
yeah.
where we
yeah,
were all really. Waiting for the other shoe to drop, and now we're talking, and I think, not to put words in your mouth, but the story to come out is the diplomacy worked.
Yeah. Wow. Imagine that.
And I mean, to Ray's point, yes, we'll have to wait until 2000 and mid 2014 to see, you know, how it all turns out and maybe beyond.
Or the next chemical attack.
Correct.
So the other surprising story is the organizations who are actually working on this, who have admittedly been somewhat skeptical, say the teams have actually all gelled very well, and we are surprisingly happy with it. The way things are moving,
we just don't know what to do with a story like this. So this is not what you usually hear.
Well, this is the question I was going to ask you. Do you think this is why, as you said yesterday, and we were talking about, do you think this is why we say what happened with Syria? I mean, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the shutdown, of course.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. But
now, Syria, we were talking about it every day for day after day. It's like, oh, now more Syria stuff. People get tired of news. They and so do the journalists covering it.
Yeah.
I think that's why you jump into something new.
But when the news turns to a point where positive things are being done.
Good things are not as fun to report about or as interesting to journalists as the negative. You're right about that.
You just made a great statement that I'd like to follow up with you on as an investigative journalist. Is there a point where boredom or the tediousness of a story will affect an investigative reporter to the point of sort of losing discipline on a story and not following through?
Yeah, it's good newsrooms manage that. And so you're working on a story and you've done everything you can. You're sick of the whole thing. And your editor will say, fine, what do you have for tomorrow? And that's hugely important because a story does go on. And then there's the opposite problem. We saw this even. It's not just investigative, but in news in general. All the people who complained about how many times they saw the towers fall down after the 9/11. Coverage. To me, that was fascinating. I'm a news junkie, so is apparently
pretty big part of it.
Well, according to some a new study, in fact, about news watching habits, we in the baby boom generation are entertained by and are interested in and love news. The younger people, not so much. They have other things that interest them. So even
is that
when
a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, it's certainly bad for news. So,
well, is it bad for culture as a whole if people don't care?
It makes me think that, but I'm a baby boomer, so I have certainly a biased viewpoint. I'd like to hear somebody from, you know, I'll ask my kids tonight and my granddaughter.
Fair enough.
Well, the thing about, from my understanding, just to go back a little bit, the concern over the showing of the towers going down over and over and over again had to do with a couple of things. First of all, in respect to the victims' families, and showing that, but also for just that you were showing a murder over and over and over again, and not that you take it away, and I never believed that. I thought it should be shown and you shouldn't take that away, but I certainly did understand the call which several news outlets did, CBS being the I think probably doing it the best at the time, which was saying we are about to show this footage, which we feel is very important footage, but it's strong, and just offer a warning.
You know, I don't think so, Joe. That was an issue at the time, but I see it as part of ongoing complaints about how the media just keeps beating something to death over and over again. It's in every story where we're taught you have to put the background in. That means rehashing old stuff. Well, you put it in because you cannot assume everybody knows as much as you do.
But
readers
is the background
see that as, why are we doing that again?
But if you do it as information, I think what people were upset about was the image.
Well, it was definitely a disturbing image. But do you not show it because it bothers people? So now we get to Syria. That's difficult because there were people dying and Americans were not interested because we've really been taught and have a natural inclination not to be interested in death elsewhere or problems
so
elsewhere.
Let's escape 9/11 for a moment and just go back to the situation which was held, the situation that happened on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House when a young woman takes her car. She goes through the barrier. She is shot. They remove a child from the car.
Right.
That video also was shown over and over again. They came under networks came under a lot of fire because it was a child involved. The networks then pixelated the child.
But within hours.
And again, that video was shown over and again. And here again, there was that argument of, you know, is this something that we should be showing? Can we tell that story? Can we give that information, as you said, without showing that particular aspect of it, of the woman being
killed? Well, you know, of course you can, but it isn't going to be as interesting or titillating as showing the whole footage. And the problem is the 24/7 news cycle we have now. We didn't have this problem when I began in the business. You put out one edition a day in a newspaper, three on radio, two on TV, so you weren't repeating it. But now there's stations that run around the clock. Yeah, so right. How are you going to tell the story?
But is it really, I mean, I'm on the fence about that one.
Yeah.
But is it really titillation? You're showing what happened. And it was the main thing of what happened.
Right.
I mean, this woman went on a driving rampage and was shot. I mean, they have it on
film.
Is it titillation? It's compelling, certainly.
I don't think having the footage and showing it is titillation. I do wonder about, you know, leading your cast with it and showing it over and over and over again and having it as a loop as you talk.
Yeah.
And while you were at the desk, I'm sorry, the command center, as they call
it.
Yes. All right. Yeah,
there is the video that is playing just over and over and over again on the bottom. And I think, you know, I think those kind of things are issues that I do think, you know, should be, because if you're showing what essentially is in that case, I mean, it's a tragic case of a young woman and she's killed, and there are great questions of questions.
Yeah.
We're still getting a lot of mail from people who saying that it was
reaction was too strong.
The reaction was too strong.
Yeah, that
it was
baby
an
was
abusive
in the car
force.
And they shot, and that's under investigation. But you know, we're putting news values and ethical values into showing the film. I think for many people, it's simply boring. They wanted to see it once, maybe twice, and then after that, it's like, I'm bored. I don't want to see it anymore.
Well, that's the other thing. The 24-hour news cycle, that I think you're exactly right. I think, but with the 24-hour news cycle, this is going to sound horrible and crass. However, I think we all, a lot of us, fall into this where they say, hey, did you see the footage of?
Right.
And you say, no. And then you go to your computer and you type in, boom, you watch it, and then you're done.
Right.
You've done it. You've seen whatever horrible thing or whatever funny thing or whatever weird thing that
so
has
then
happened.
A study comes out and looks at how many minutes someone in each generation is spending on news, and is it surprising that the younger generations spend much less time watching news than we do?
Is it just a question of priorities at a certain age? In other words, did you watch as much news when you were 17?
No, the study controlled for that and found that as they were getting older, they were keeping with the lower limits. And actually, even the boomers watch less news than did the silent generation, the generation before us. I like the names they give to generations.
Yes.
Who does
silent.
That?
I know.
Is it the
I don't know.
Same people
Walter
who name
Cronkite,
hurricanes? Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, he did
no,
most of that.
No, that's just
for
the Weather Channel just makes stuff up.
Maybe they make up the names of generations, too. We'll call them the millennials.
What are we in now? The
millennials.
The millennials. How nice.
Yeah.
Let's move on to one other topic because we're just about out of time. And I love this story.
Oh,
I'm just thrilled about this story. It came out just about an hour ago. Alice Munro, the wonderful Canadian short story writer who's been around for a long time. She's 82 years old. She was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, 13th woman to receive that prize. And she has really been an incredible force in literature for a long, long time, and is a beloved writer and certainly someone. When I heard this morning, I just was like, "Go, man!"
I'm assigning myself her latest short story collection, which I have not read. And to me, that was the most interesting thing, was that it wasn't a big grand novel or production. She's being honored for the short story, which is just a wonderful literary form.
The biggest part is 82. I mean, this is
well,
great.
Well, it's a lifetime of work.
Oh, it's
you know,
for the
I
lifetime
mean, it's
of
based
work.
On yeah. It's based on their body of work that they have done over over their career, the span of their career, and it she does have novels, but the work is almost entirely of short stories, and I believe
they gave a special notice to that. They gave a special mention in the citation about the wonderful short stories that she's dominated for.
In fact, I believe Wives of Girls and Women is her only novel. And the rest
you
was
know more about
short,
it than I do. But she did say what last year that she wasn't going to write anymore. She was retiring.
And
so maybe this will change your mind.
That was my thought. Kind of a nice. She said she knew she was in the running, but she never thought she would win. And she is based in Ontario. And, you know, when you think of all of the people, George Saunders, who is a great American short story writer who's been on our book show and is absolutely fantastic, has one of the best books out this year, and Jonathan Franzen and Margaret Atwood, mm-hmm. all these people who talk about Alice Munro of being such a force and a model to them, it's a wonderful thing to see. Mm. I also do think it is interesting that, you know, this is the one I wait for. I don't know the physicist. I'm sorry. I should, but I don't, you know.
Well, that was a cool story of Higgs, the Higgs boson, whatever the heck that is. Readers maybe.
Well, it gives things mass.
Mass, and it's
so
like
in other words,
water
it's a particle of an atom.
Right. That's so you know. Anyway, yeah. He won. Of course, it had been widely rumored he was going to win, and he was off someplace in Scotland. No one could get him. They weren't even sure if he had.
Well, they got him on a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
It was a great,
pretty cool,
great story. Rosemary, we're going to miss you. You're off, and we'll be back for a couple of days. She'll be back at the end of October.
Yep.
So we wish you luck in. Presenting your paper, and
thank you very much. Have fun while I'm gone.
We will. We'll miss you. We'll, you know, we have all these issues of trying to, you know, fill your shoes. They're big shoes to fill, but we'll do our best. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Raymond, we'll see you tomorrow.
No, you won't. I'll be presenting a paper. Actually, I'll be reading a story to my daughter's first grade class, Green Eggs and Ham,
all right, so
in the Shakespearean style.
Will you do it like Ted Cruz?
No, I'm going to frighten the children by doing it in full Shakespearean mode.
Apparently, then, it's just going to be me talking about topics tomorrow.
Enjoy.
I look forward
finally
to it.
Finally, you get your wish.
That's my wish. Our dear friend Paul Conte will be joining us tomorrow. So we look forward to that, and I'm sure we'll rope somebody else in between now and then. Coming up next, the roundtable continues. We'll talk to M. Night Shyamalan about education reform and movies. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.